call his people, and said he'd meet with him early the next morning. "We have to keep the ship on an even keel," he said. Wells's death was front-page news in the next morning's Los Angeles Times, which reported that he and two others were killed when their helicopter crashed in the remote Ruby Mountains in northeast Nevada. "There are no words to express my shock and sense of loss," Eisner said in a prepared statement. "Frank Wells has been the purest definition of a life force I have ever known. His wisdom, his charm, his zest for experience and challenge, his naked and awesome intelligence set him apart and beyond. The world has lost a great human being." As Katzenberg pulled into the parking garage at 6:30 that morning, he noticed Eisner's car wasn't there yet. He cleared his schedule, canceling lunch and dinner plans in case Eisner needed him, as he assumed he would. Overnight, Katzenberg had thought of little else but the assurance Eisner had given him at Aspen that if anything ever happened to Wells, Katzenberg would succeed him. Of course, he'd never expected anything so sudden, so tragic as this. Wells had been a mediator between him and Eisner so often, and Katzenberg would miss him. But fate moved in unexpected ways. At age 43, Katzenberg was ready for the partnership with Eisner that they'd discussed for so long and that now seemed within his grasp. Katzenberg waited anxiously. Surely Eisner knew he was there. He had to have seen his car. Each time the phone rang, he thought it must be the summons from Eisner. As time passed, other studio executives dropped by, shocked and apprehensive and, at the same time, intensely curious about Katzenberg's future. Katzenberg did his best to reassure them, urging them not to let Frank's death distract them from work. Finally, he couldn't take the suspense any longer and dialed Eisner's office. Martin answered. "Do you need anything?" Katzenberg asked. "Is there anything I can do to help?" "He's in a telephonic board meeting," she answered. The directors had convened by telephone to discuss the Wells succession issue, and were at that moment making Eisner chairman and president. Katzenberg was stunned by the news. He was the number three executive in the company. Eisner hadn't spoken to him, and yet he had already convened a board meeting. Katzenberg tried to turn his attention to his work. As always, there was plenty to do. Beauty and the Beast was about to open on Broadway. Lion King was in the final edit. Lasseter and the Pixar people were trying to schedule a screening of Toy Story. Finally, at about 11:30, Martin called, and Katzenberg's expectations rose again. But it was just to say that Eisner would be going ahead with his regularly scheduled Monday staff lunch. Eisner's decision to assume the title of president himself was meant to reassure Wall Street, but also to send a firm message to Katzenberg. That morning, Eisner had again discussed the matter with his usual circle of close advisors, Bass, Gold, Russell, and Litvak. They agreed that, at least as a temporary measure, Eisner should assume Wells's titles. The subject of Katzenberg did come up. Eisner told Roy that Jeffrey wants to be president, and Roy responded that, "I don't think that's a good idea." Although Roy felt Katzenberg's behavior had been improving, he still thought he spent too much time talking about "I" rather than "we," and that he was rude to subordinates. But Roy insists that Eisner never asked me to make Jeffrey president.